From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The saga of the president-elect's vacant Senate seat took another turn today. Former Illinois Attorney General Roland Burris was turned away from taking the seat formerly held by Barack Obama in the U.S. Senate. He spoke to reporters in the rain on Capitol grounds today.
I presented my credentials to the Secretary of the Senate and advised that my credentials were not in order and I would not be accepted, nor would I be seated, nor would I be permitted on the floor.
Burris was appointed by Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. Blagojevich was recently charged with trying to sell the U.S. Senate seat vacated by Obama. But instead of recusing himself from making an appointment, the governor went ahead and defiantly named Burris as his pick. If seated, Burris would be the fourth black senator since Reconstruction. And we've got an update on this story from NPR's Midwest reporter, Cheryl Corley. She joins us from Chicago. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi.
So this is big news. For people who aren't familiar with Burris, give us a little bit of background on him.
Okay. Well, Roland Burris is 71, lived in Chicago for a good portion of his adult life, but grew up in a very small town in Illinois, where as a teenager he tried to integrate the local swimming pool. He's an attorney, began his career in banking, and he was the first African-American to be elected to a statewide office. He served three terms as the state's comptroller. He served one term as the attorney general, and he's run unsuccessfully for a number of other positions, including governor for the U.S. Senate seat and for mayor of Chicago, was unsuccessful in all of those. And he's been out of political life since 1995, when his term of attorney general ended.
So this is a situation where you might assume, well, okay, he's black and, you know, maybe he should be seated. But some people who might, based on people's assumptions about skin color or party affiliation, have supported him are now against him. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, there's a couple of things going on. The argument is that the appointment is tainted. As you mentioned, Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich faces federal corruption charges, accused of trying to sell the Senate seat in return for favors and monies. So his critics say that anyone who is appointed by him should not be accepted. And I should point out, too, that the governor has denied the charges that he tried to sell this seat. On the other hand, Roland Burris and his supporters say that this is a political fight, not a legal one, that the governor has the power to make the appointment, that Rob Blagojevich is still the governor, even though the Illinois House is considering whether to impeach him. And Roland Burris said today, as he's been saying all week, that every law in the book backs him up.
Now, the Congressional Black Caucus doesn't really have any official sway in the Senate, but have they weighed in on this?
Well, they really haven't. Of course, one of the staunchest supporters of Roland Burris is Congressman Bobby Rush, who held a big rally for him, and he has been lobbying members of the Congressional Black Caucus. Another Illinois congressman, Danny Davis, is also supportive of Roland Burris, and I should point out that Davis turned down an offer from the governor to take the seat. The Congressional Black Caucus meets tomorrow and is likely to discuss this matter then, but it hasn't really taken an official position.
With the inauguration coming up so soon, how is Chicago reacting to not just this situation with Burris, but also the larger one with the governor?
Well, you know, this has been the city really has kind of a split personality right now. I mean, because you have, you know, still the euphoria of President-elect Obama about to be sworn into office, and then the situation with the governor and with Roland Burris. Most people here are condemning what they think the governor did, but still trying to let this whole legal process take its court. As the governor and Roland Burris says, you know, innocent and till proven guilty. So, you know, people have their opinions, but they are willing to wait and see what happens in that respect.
Well, it's great to talk to you. Thanks, Cheryl.
You're quite welcome.
That was NPR's Cheryl Corley talking to us by phone. And we're going to dig more into the issues around Roland Burris with Sherilyn Eiffel. She's a civil rights lawyer and law professor at the University of Maryland Law School. Sherilyn, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Farai?
I'm doing great. So let's just go to a little bit more of this. This is what Roland Burris said to a pack of reporters at Chicago's Midway Airport yesterday.
I mean, I don't have to separate myself from Rod Blagojevich. He carried out his duties, and he filled the vacancy as according to law. Isn't that correct? Isn't that what the statute says? That this governor shall appoint a person to fill the vacancy. It didn't say anything about being tainted or being associated with or being, you know, stink. I mean, this is all politics and theater. But I am the junior senator according to every law book in the nation.
All right. What do the law books say?
Well, the law books say that, according to the Supreme Court's decision in Powell versus McCormick, that each House of Congress is essentially limited by Article 1, Section 5 of the Constitution to determining whether or not the candidate for office who's either been elected or appointed has met the minimum qualifications, that is age and citizenship and so forth. And this case, of course, came out of the efforts in the House to not seat Adam Clayton Powell after he was under an ethics cloud for misusing funds in office and for having various family members on the payroll. And Congress essentially said that the voters have the right to put into office who they want to put into office and that the House could not nullify the election of Adam Clayton Powell that the voters had endorsed. And everyone's talking about the Powell case. It's not exactly on all fours with the situation that we have here. There's no question but that Powell suggested that Congress's power is limited. But in that case, the court also said that Congress has an interest, a strong interest, in preserving the integrity of its chambers, and that in most cases, that interest can be realized through Congress's vote to expel members of Congress. So Powell didn't actually deal with this kind of case, in which you have an allegation against the governor, and not some wild-eyed allegation by somebody, for example, in the media, but an allegation lodged by Patrick Fitzgerald, a respected United States attorney. We've seen the transcripts, and some of us have heard the videotapes in terms of talking about the seat. We've had corroboration from other elected officials, including Jesse Jackson Jr., about the efforts of Blagojevich to try and get something for the seat. And the charges are about the very process by which the seat would be filled. So it seems to me it makes perfect sense for Congress to be concerned about a nominee who's selected by that governor, who's under this cloud, about his efforts to fill that seat in an improper and illegitimate way. The question, Sherilyn, is technically what can Congress do?
Right. Well, speaking of technically what can Congress and the Senate do, the Secretary of the Senate rejected his certificate of appointment, Burris's, that is, because it didn't have the signature of the Illinois mm-hmm. Secretary of State. So how does that play out? I mean, will there now be an attempt to, you know, try to get the Illinois Secretary of State on board, I suppose, by Burris's team?
Well, absolutely. That buys, you know, Harry Reid and the Democrats a little bit of time, because, of course, the failure of the Illinois Secretary of State to sign the appointment certificate does mean that the papers were not in order. And according to standing rules of the Senate, that appointment paper has to be signed by the state Secretary of State. So what that does is buy a little bit of time for some negotiation to happen. Obviously, Burris and his legal team are seeking to enjoin the Secretary of State of Illinois, compelling the Secretary of State to provide the signature, which they regard as being something that's perfunctory. So that's going to the Illinois Supreme Court. There are motions due on that on Wednesday, which is ironically the same day that Burris and his team will likely be meeting with Harry Reid and other top Senate Democrats. So that buys some time for the negotiation. Technically, the Senate is within the limits of the law right now because the signature was not there. If the Illinois Supreme Court compels the Secretary of State to affix the signature to the appointment letter, then we're really in harsh legal terrain, in which I think the Senate is in a much weaker position, technically speaking, as to whether or not they can choose not to seat Burris. I'll tell you one thing people aren't talking about, Farai, that I think the Senate can do, but which they may not have the stomach to do, and that is that they can refer the matter to the Rules Committee. If they believe someone was either elected under corruption or appointed under pay for play, they have the right, it seems to me, under Powell versus McCormick, to refer the matter to their Rules Committee and launch an investigation. They don't want to do that because I don't think they want to turn this matter into being about Roland Burris. This is about Blagojevich. And
well,
so the Senate is kind of caught in a strange position.
Well, let me jump in on that. Just a little bit of the cultural nuance of this. We spoke with Cheryl Corley just a couple minutes ago about U.S. Congressman Bobby Rush of Illinois' First District, and he called the U.S. Senate, quote, the last bastion of plantation politics. What does that say about the cultural debate about whether or not a black man appointed by a governor under a cloud of suspicion? I mean, what do we make of the racial politics of this?
You know what's funny, Farah? I think for lots of African-Americans watching that press conference where Blagojevich appointed, announced the appointment of Burris and Bobby Rush made his first, you know, statements about race, it was almost like a flashback. I mean, we'd had this whole election with Barack Obama. And then we had this moment where it looked like it was something out of the 80s. The reality is that the election of Obama shows us, and the election of Obama to the Senate shows us, that a black man can be elected to the Senate, that we don't need to get to the United States Senate under a cloud or under a tainted nomination that had been turned down by other folks who didn't want to go under the cloud. So I think what it shows, Farai, is that we've still got this generational split and this cultural split about race. You know, Bobby Rush, as I recall, I don't think he supported the candidacy of Senator Obama when he was running for the Senate against a white opponent. So if this were just about, you know, we've got to have a black person in the Senate, then we would need to show some consistency there. I think we're seeing, you know, people like Roland Burris and Bobby Rush, who've made tremendous contributions and who are of a generation who I think feel that perhaps their contributions have not been fully acknowledged and they don't feel appreciated. You hear Roland Burris saying over and over again, I am qualified. I am qualified. And he certainly has a fairly distinguished record of public service in Illinois. Mm-hmm. And so I think what we're seeing is that racial generational split just play out over this nomination.
Well, Sherrilyn, always great to talk to you. Thank you.
Same here. Thanks, Farai.
That was Sherrilyn Ifill. She's a civil rights lawyer and law professor at the University of Maryland Law School. She joined us from the studios of WEAA in Baltimore. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. It's time now for our Africa update. This week, we remember South Africa's anti-apartheid crusader, Helen Suzman. Plus, Ethiopian peacekeeping troops leave Somalia as violence escalates. For the latest, we've got Roxanne Lawson. She's director of Africa policy for Trans-Africa Forum. Hi, Roxanne.
Hello, Farai.
So let's talk about the celebrated anti-apartheid campaigner, Helen Suzman. She died on New Year's Day, 91 years old, not someone necessarily that a lot of Americans would know about, but she was the only white lawmaker for years to condemn the whites-only regime. And she spoke with NPR in 1993, a few months before South Africa's first multiracial elections.
Trying to maintain segregation in an integrated economy was absolutely hopeless, and it meant terrible disaster to the lives of millions of people. Naturally, bitterness built up over the years, and black resistance escalated, and that's why the government over and over again had to introduce states of emergency.
So tell us a little bit more about Suzman and why people want to keep her memory alive.
Well, Helen Suzman is actually quite an inspiration to many South Africans, regardless of race. She was, at 36 years, a member of parliament, elected and stayed and held her seat during the worst parts of apartheid, when the government's, you know, total security onslaught had displaced most white activists who were fighting against apartheid from being able to have any political voice. Suzman maintained her parliamentary seat and spoke out against police torture, abuses in prisons, herself visiting Robben Island several times around the cruelty of apartheid, and was really a very prominent voice speaking against apartheid and the only one to have any kind of political weight within the apartheid system within South Africa.
How did she make sense of South African politics post-apartheid? What did she see when she looked out at the nation?
I think, like many people who were part of the struggle to end apartheid, she was critical of the ANC government for their shortcomings, for the lack of reform of education, for some of the lack of political and economic disbursement among the different classes in South Africa, and spoke out often and frequently about the need for South Africans post-apartheid to really deal with economic and social implications of apartheid and the kind of unwritten rules that existed politically and socially within South Africa. She was critical of the ANC government for not living up in many ways to what the people had struggled for in South Africa, and was among still a progressive and powerful voice within South Africa.
Well, when we look at party politics in South Africa, there are some new kids on the block, or rather experienced politicians on the block. The former ANC defense minister has helped to start a new political party, the Congress of the People, or COPE. What is that about?
Well, COPE essentially is a splinter of the ANC, and they say that they're trying to actually bring the ANC back, or bring South Africa back, to the real demands of post-apartheid voices in South Africa. And so they've come together to be a kind of anchor and an alternative power force against the ANC. I think for those of us looking at South African politics, both in and outside of South Africa, it's a very exciting and interesting thing to witness, to see in which the ways in which political transformation are happening in South Africa as it moves further and further into, I guess, its political, out of its political infancy into the next political phase. The kind of show up on, of COPE on the scene is actually something that's really very powerful and positive. It'll make the ANC, I think, more accountable to its constituencies, much more on guard around the need for the lack of political autonomy or political accountability to people in South Africa. I think that the ANC is a really wonderful and beautiful thing, but that it needs to have a counterbalance, and COPE may play that role.
All right, let's move on to the Horn of Africa, where yesterday there was fresh fighting between Somali insurgents and government soldiers. Ethiopian troops that have been protecting the UN-backed government there have started pulling out, and Uganda also has threatened to withdraw peacekeepers. What does this really mean on the ground for people who are in the region?
Well, on the ground for the average Somali, it's even more exasperating. As many people know, over 80,000 people have been displaced in the last 2 years. 60,000 have been killed. 30,000 are injured and suffering from a myriad of health problems. Many people who are displaced are actually now twice displaced, first from the capital city of Mogadishu and now from towns, neighboring towns in and around Somalia. Practically what this is that the Ethiopian troops, although they've missed their deadline for withdrawal, are trying to withdraw from the country of Somalia since their occupation is very unpopular with Somalis. Somalis want to govern themselves and want to have the right to be politically autonomous, and they feel that the role of Ethiopia and its backing by the U.S. government is keeping them from doing that. But with their withdrawal comes increased fighting. The Somali insurgent forces, some of which are organized, some of which are not organized, are taking over bases that Ethiopian troops are evacuating. And for the African Union forces, who are mostly, almost all, from Uganda and Burundi, they feel like they're unable to do their jobs as peacekeepers and want the ability to be able to protect Somalis by using force.
I want to make sure that we at least briefly touch on what is the road ahead in Africa policy and for the continent. So maybe a good place to start is with this region, with East Africa, with Somalia. What might help stabilize not only Somalia, but some of the other regional governments?
Well, in the Horn of Africa, Somalia in particular, for us as Trans-Africa Forum, we think that the U.S. needs to stop backing Ethiopia and Ethiopia aggression in the region. Right now, the Ethiopian government is run by a dictator, which many Ethiopians are critical of. The opposition party in Ethiopia has been in prison since the elections a few years ago. And so we think that, that a change in U.S. foreign policy toward Ethiopia will help both the people of Ethiopia, the people of Somalia, and help to stabilize the region. There's also a role for the United Nations to play, to continue to provide material assistance and aid to the people who've been displaced, to the people who are imprisoned. And that's an important place to start. Looking across the continent, in Southern Africa, focus on Zimbabwe and on the neighboring countries still needs to happen. As the African Union works to resolve the problem in Zimbabwe, we as international community need to support that resolution, both politically and militarily. But economically as well, and not militarily. I think in North Africa, where we've had a really nice election in Ghana that was peaceful through and through, we need to support more democratization processes like that and look to the continent to actually have new leadership in the, over the next year. 2009, I think, will be a really important year for both regional bodies in the continent and for individual countries. We have many elections coming up.
Just very quickly, what do you think is the industry or industries that might bring some economic good news to the continent?
Well, I think, unfortunately, right now, most of the industries on the continent have only brought economic bad news because of the inequity of trade and of the very large debt burden, which hasn't been canceled. I think that in 2009, if we can, through U.S. Congress, have a really nice African Growth and Opportunity Act, which is better than the past iterations that have really focused on oil, gas, and mining and actually have some diversity where real economic development can happen on the continent, then we're looking at really increased sectors and across the continent. And so we're looking at some structural changes in the way in which we do mining with the continent, both international corporations and the United States, as we support our corporations investing on the continent. A shift in investment. Go ahead.
Unfortunately, we have to wrap up here. But Roxanne, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Roxanne Lawson is Director of Africa Policy for TransAfrica Forum, and she was at our headquarters in Washington. Here's a listener favorite from 2008. At the tender age of 8, Emmanuel Jal was recruited to fight in a guerrilla war. He took up arms for the Sudan People's Liberation Army, a militia that was fighting the government of Sudan. As a child soldier, Jal went into battle carrying an AK-47 that was taller than he was. He later escaped to Kenya. Now Emmanuel Jal makes music that talks about his history as a child soldier and the need for peace. His new CD is War Child, and it mixes traditional African sounds with hip-hop vibes. Emmanuel recently shared some of his extraordinary life story.
I believe I've survived for a reason to tell my story, to touch life.
I was driven by my village when my village was burned down and we were running all over here and there, our cows, and my mom died in the time of the war, and then this my sister's displaced, and basically it's a kind of a revenge, a bit, you know, when you're bitter, you know. That's what driven me. So, but other people were freedom fighters like the adults. But as the young people, most of us were not forced to do it anything, to go to war. But the first battle wasn't easy. You know, you feel like you're scared, you know. But once you pull the trigger, you know, you just dance to the beat of the gun because it pulls you up and on until when you survive or when you're dead.
Your life took a lot of different turns where you trekked through the desert and not everyone who was with you survived. Later on, you met an aid worker, Emma McCune, who passed away later in a car accident, but she got you into Kenya. What was it like to decompress from being in a situation where every day you had to fight for survival to being in a situation where your life was more like the lives of people, for example, who might be listening to this radio show?
My escape, you know, and when the things were really horrible, you know, you kind of sometimes want to lose hope. Will this war ever end? What's going to happen? What's happened with my brothers and sisters? Because I lost contact with my family. So that was frustrating. And my trek in the desert wasn't easy, you know, seeing some of my friend die and watching somebody starving to death is not a good thing because somebody becomes skinny. And also me getting tempted even to eat one of my best friend because there was no food and the cannibalism that broke out there. But when I arrived in Word, it wasn't easy because even though when I met Emma McCune and she had so much sympathy and wanting to take me and adopt me, in my mind I was still thinking I'm a soldier, but I had nightmares. She would wake up and try to talk to me. No, you're not in Sudan. You're in a safe place now. There's no war. Sometimes maybe if I'm in a place and bored, I may start playing like a soldier and naming stuff and fighting when there's no someone to fight. So it's crazy.
It's what people now call post-traumatic stress disorder. And do you ever deal with it now, just waking up in the middle of the night and thinking you might be back in a war zone?
I would say, thank God, most of my problems were in Kenya. Most of it, you know, because you see, when I came to Kenya, I got a lot of love and a lot of attention from different people, like Emma's friends and her, giving me good treat, taking me and appreciating me. And even when I'm wrong, they're not beating on me or jumping on me. So they were a bit soft to me and educating me. And also, because Kenya is amazing, I start going to churches, you know, and music. I listen to positive music that encourage, that is good for my soul. So, and listening to people's stories and getting to learn the world. Bless.
you. R.I.P.
What would I be?
Telly, bad hungry belly, lies in my eyes, had to be for my size. Just another little starving child, running around in Africa, born to be wise.
Emma McKeon was a gift to our community. I only thought I was the only one rescued, but I realized she rescued over 157 child soldiers. And apart from that, wherever she goes, she touched people's hearts, mine, and leave a smile. And she was somebody who was dedicated, really, and loving the people and wanting to do all her best to help them come out of the poverty and also the heart she has for young people and demobilizing child soldiers. But apart from that, it's the love that she's given me, you know, staying with her. She took me to the best school in Kenya. And when she smuggled me, you know, I didn't have clothes to wear, so I was wearing her clothes, her shoes. And I was like a little brother because I'll sleep with her in the same bed. And also when I was in Kenya, people would tell her, why are you taking care of this kid? You're wasting your time. You should send him to a children's home or something, you know. And she didn't give up and she gave me the best education. And that's why I'm able to speak English. And there's nothing much, there's no way I can say thank you to her, but it's just to make her name known.
Let's talk about some of the other songs on War Child. There's one called Forced to Sin, where you talk about really what it's like to be a soldier. Tell me about that song.
Forced to sin to make a living. Forced to sin to make a living. Sometimes you gotta lose to win. Never give up, never give in.
When I was in a refugee camp, I did everything to survive, you know, and me and my friends, we used to go and steal chickens, and we used to go and pretend do other stuff, so just to make a living. And I've reached here because of the horrible things I've done, but I'm saying it's not great, but sometimes we are forced to sin to make a living.
We used to raid villages, stealing chickens, goats, and ships, anything we could eat. I knew it was rude, but we needed food. And therefore I was forced to sin, forced to sin.
You know, at this point in time, you've seen so many things that other people haven't, and you've written that into your music. Are you hopeful that your music can transform lives?
I'm hopeful because it's helped me as a person, and it's communicating for my country. And different places where I perform, I meet different people. They say, I've listened to your music, and you're inspiring, and I thought I had so much problem, but just listening to what you're saying and looking at you just make me keep on moving. And it used to depress me talking about my story and doing all this, but it energized somebody and it makes somebody appreciate life. That's what also encouraged me to say, okay, nothing just happens, everything happened for a reason.
Emmanuel, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Sure, thank you.
Sudanese musician and former child soldier Emmanuel Jal. His new CD is called War Child.
I was born in Sudan in a place called Tony, in a village by the river where the people born strong. Respective of the fact that the place is war torn, the people are still strong.
At the tender age of 8, Emmanuel Jal was recruited to fight in a guerrilla war. He took up arms for the Sudan People's Liberation Army, a militia that was fighting the government of Sudan. As a child soldier, Jal went into battle carrying an AK-47 that was taller than he was. He later escaped to Kenya. Now Emmanuel Jal makes music that talks about his history as a child soldier and the need for peace. His new CD is War Child, and it mixes traditional African sounds with hip-hop vibes.
Oh,
Emmanuel recently shared some of his extraordinary life story.
I believe I've survived for a reason to tell my story, to touch life.
I was driven by my village when my village was burned down, and we were running all over here and there, our cows, and my mom died in the time of the war, and then this my sister's displaced, and basically it's a kind of a revenge, a bit, you know, when you're bitter, you know, that's what driven me. So, but other people were freedom fighters like the adults, but as the young people, most of us were not forced to do it anything, to go to war. But the first battle wasn't easy, you know, you feel like you're scared, you know, but once you've pulled the trigger, you know, you just dance to the beat of the gun, because it pulls you up and on until when you survive or when you're dead.
Your life took a lot of different turns where you trekked through the desert and not everyone who was with you survived. Later on, you met an aid worker, Emma McCune, who passed away later in a car accident, but she got you into Kenya. What was it like to decompress from being in a situation where every day you had to fight for survival to being in a situation where your life was more like the lives of people, for example, who might be listening to this radio show?
My escape, you know, and when the things were really horrible, you know, you kind of sometimes want to lose hope. Will this war ever end? What's going to happen? What's happened with my brothers and sisters? Because I lost contact with my family. So that was frustrating. And my trek in the desert wasn't easy, you know, seeing some of my friend die and watching somebody starving to death. It's not a good thing, because some would become skinny. And also me getting tempted even to eat one of my best friend, because there was no food, and the cannibalism that broke out there. But when I arrived in Word, it wasn't easy, because even though when I met Emma McCune and she had so much sympathy and wanting to take me and adopt me, in my mind I was still thinking I'm a soldier, but I had nightmares. She would wake up and try to talk to me. No, you're not in Sudan. You're in a safe place now. There's no war. Sometimes maybe if I'm in a place and bored, I may start playing like a soldier and naming stuff and fighting when there's no someone to fight. So it's crazy.
It's what people now call post-traumatic stress disorder. And do you ever deal with it now, just waking up in the middle of the night and thinking you might be back in a war zone?
I would say, thank God, most of my problems were in Kenya. Most of it, you know, because you see, when I came to Kenya, I got a lot of love and a lot of attention from different people, like Emma's friends and her, giving me good treat, taking me and appreciating me. And even when I'm wrong, they're not beating on me or jumping on me. So they were a bit soft to me and educating me. And also, because Kenya is amazing, I start going to churches, you know, and music, where music, I listen to positive music that encourage, that is good for my soul. So, and listening to people's stories and getting to learn the world.
Bless you. For my size, that's another little starving child running around in Africa, born to be wise.
Emma McCune was a gift to our community. I only thought I was the only one rescued, but I realized she rescued over 157 child soldiers. And apart from that, wherever she goes, she touched people's hearts, mine, and leave a smile. And she was somebody who was dedicated, really, and loving the people. And wanting to do all her best to help them come out of the poverty, and also the heart she has for young people and demobilizing child soldiers. But apart from that, it's the love that she's given me, you know, staying with her. She took me to the best school in Kenya. And when she smuggled me, you know, I didn't have clothes to wear, so I was wearing her clothes, her shoes. And I was like a little brother because I'll sleep with her in the same bed. And also when I was in Kenya, people would tell her, why are you taking care of this kid? You're wasting your time. You should send him to a children's home or something, you know. And she didn't give up, and she gave me the best education. That's why I'm able to speak English. And there's nothing much, there's no way I can say thank you to her, but it's just to make her name known.
Let's talk about some of the other songs on War Child. There's one called Forced to Sin, where you talk about really what it's like to be a soldier. Tell me about that song.
Forced to sin to make a living. Forced to sin to make a living. Sometimes you gotta lose to win. Never give up, never give in.
When I was in a refugee camp, I did everything to survive, you know. And me and my friends, we used to go and steal chickens, and we used to go and pretend do other stuff, so just to make a living. And I've reached here because of the horrible things I've done, but I'm saying it's not great. But sometimes we are forced to sin to make a living.
We used to raid villages, stealing chickens, goats, and ships, anything we could eat. I knew it was rude, but we needed food, and therefore I was forced to sin, forced to sin.
You know, at this point in time, you've seen so many things that other people haven't, and you've written that into your music. Are you hopeful that your music can transform lives?
I'm hopeful because it's helped me as a person, and it's communicating for my country. And different places where I perform, I meet different people. They say, I've listened to your music, and you're inspiring, and I thought I had so much problem, but just listening to what you're saying and looking at you just make me keep on moving. And it used to depress me talking about my story and doing all this, but it energized somebody and it makes somebody appreciate life. That's what also encouraged me to say, okay, nothing just happens, everything happened for a reason.
Emmanuel, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Sure, thank you.
Sudanese musician and former child soldier Emmanuel Jal. His new CD is called War Child.
I was born in Sudan in a place called Tony, in a village by the river where the people born strong. Irrespective of the fact that the place is war-torn, the people are still strong. Life is simple, people humble. They have been oppressed, oppressed, but they overcame this kind of struggle. What I love about my people is that in the hard time they can still...
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. In the 1980s and early 1990s, an increasing number of Americans watched and sometimes supported the struggle to end apartheid in South Africa. Very few Americans got to see the struggle early and up close. One of them was Frank B. Wilderson III, who became one of just two Americans to be elected to the African National Congress. He's written Incognito, a memoir of exile and apartheid. Welcome to News and Notes, and congratulations on the American Book Award that you got.
Thanks, Farai. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So, you know, this book starts out, and, you know, you're someone who has a literary side as well as all of your life experiences of practical politics, I'll put it that way. And this book is very literary. So how did you decide to, first of all, approach your story at all and then to put it in this kind of this writing that's very vivid?
Well, I often say that the book wrote me in that I went to South Africa in 1989 on a Jerome Foundation grant. I won a lot of money in creative writing awards, and one of them stipulated that I finish a novel that I was working on about two black guys from Dartmouth, people I'd gone to school with, and one had gone to Morocco to be in the Peace Corps in some way, and when it gone to South Africa as a journalist. And so this was going to help me complete that novel. When I got to South Africa, however, I found that the reality on the ground was so surreal and so different, even though I'd studied Southern African politics at Dartmouth College, that I couldn't fit it into a novel. So I just kept a journal. And I ultimately knew that there was something important going on here and that I was witnessing it. I did not know at the time that I would become a member of an armed insurgent group. I'd be an elected official in the ANC, that I'd be there for 5 years. I just knew that this context that I was encountering could not be forged into the novel that I had thought. So I just kept a journal for 5 years. And ultimately, in 2002 or to 2004, it became a book.
Yeah. Let's go into your book. You start out with a journalist calling and tracking you down and saying, oh, Nelson Mandela, by the way, thinks that you're a threat to national security in South Africa. What was that about, and how, you know, explain to us the context for that?
I can only hit the high points because it's a very long and complicated story. But in point of fact, there close South Africa watchers will know this, and others may not know this, that when Mandela came out of prison in 1990, a rift that was already brewing began to actually manifest itself in the ANC. From simplistically put, those who want to push forward with a socialist revolution, in other words, wanted to take over the commanding heights of political economy, not just have the vote, personified in my book by Chris Hani. That's kind of a not a very complex way to do it, but it allows me to get into some of the more complex issues. And those more behind Mandela who felt that political economy in terms of capitalism should remain as it is, basically, except there should be more access to blacks from it. And when you're having a political debate between people at a round table, that's one thing. But when you're having a political debate inside an armed wing of a liberation struggle, things can get pretty dicey.
And you didn't want that armed wing to sort of fade into the background of history.
I did not.
Why?
Because we were insurgents for an ethical reorganization of civil society and political economy. And in this day and age, it's too easy to mark that kind of activity as pure terrorist activity. And I needed to tell the story from the inside in a different way. A lot of people in MK, Mkhonto we Sizwe, which is the armed wing or spear of the nation, sided with Mandela and Mbeki and those people because they didn't feel they could get a job outside of the army or the intelligence agency. They didn't have skills. And so some went for practical reasons and some stayed out for political reasons like myself.
You also, you know, you didn't just love South Africa as someone who politically was there, but you also built a life there. What was it like for you as an American to be, you know, in a place that was not your place of birth or your place of upbringing, but for which you clearly have so much love?
Complicated. People who are white treated me with the same type of derision and racism that they treated black South Africans. And then they would hear my accent. And especially if they were British, not if they were Afrikaners, but if they were British, they'd change overnight. And they'd want me to then tell them, you know, how wonderful it was and is there anything I like. So I became like the master of the one-liners. Is there anything you like about this country? Yes, an airport with daily departures. I'd say something like that, you know. And so it was very gratifying to be welcomed into a struggle that for the first few years I was there was truly about total liberation, not simply about a Western-style democracy. And to be judged on my capacity to contribute to that by black South Africans and righteous white South Africans and Indians. So that was gratifying. But living in apartheid South Africa, you know, I used to say every day was worse than the day before.
So how did you become a member of the ANC, an elected member of the ANC, as an American?
So I worked in two capacities, and they often came together and they were not supposed to come together. One was but surely being recruited into underground activity, and there's supposed to be a firewall between the other, in which I eventually became, it would be like being on the executive committee for the Democratic Party of Harlem or West Hollywood or something like that, a place called Hillbrow. And eventually I rose to become on the executive committee for the ANC, not just of Hillbrow, but of the entire Johannesburg sub-region. I was teaching at the University of Witwatersrand. I'm a critical theorist in my other hat at the University of California, Irvine. And I was teaching in comparative literature, a critical theory course on Foucault, Gramsci, Edward Said, people like that. And I was only working one day a week. I was waiting tables. My ex-wife was a member, and she was a law student. And someone came to the door to collect dues in 1991. And I said, you know, I got a lot of time, and I've been a political activist in the state. Do you accept people who were not born in the country? And he said, sure, come to the next meeting. And I came to the next meeting of, as I said, a space the size of maybe West Hollywood, got into a lot of debates. And finally, Albie Sachs's son nominated me in a general election for the executive of the branch. And I rose up in terms of committees and elected officials positions in that side. And I was involved in the in another world as well.
Do you feel that people really trusted you? People who were within the more critical side of the movement to end apartheid and to build a new South Africa, people who didn't buy into, as you said, a South Africa that just perhaps let a few people into higher economic strata?
Yes and no. And this is the part of the book that really moves back and forth between my sense of not having spent time with the four or five comrades who I'm actually working very closely with, some of whom are my students in the daytime, not having gone to the frontline states to train in insurgent camps with them, being brought in at a later point, and them having a history, me not having a history. And so there was always, I was always being deployed and never fully brought into the entire picture. Yeah.
When you look at South Africa now, and we were just talking about it earlier today on our Africa update, there's such a question about the fork in the road that faces the nation even at this point. And those questions you raised about whether or not a post-apartheid era should bring many people into greater economic empowerment, or whether it's enough to just sort of change the faces in the game at the top. How do you think South Africa's doing?
Very poorly. And this isn't just my thinking. A great scholar and activist and thinker, Andile Ngaba, from South Africa, who's written a lot, also believes this. Unfortunately, one doesn't want to say, I want apartheid South Africa back. I want a partition state. Yet one has to also see that the sellout of the Mandela and Mbeki regime has brought about a worse economic condition than what people had before. And with rampant AIDS, there's been a complete kind of compromise formation to International Monetary Fund, GATT, and the World Bank. And what is most problematic is not just the policies, but the fact that mass mobilization has been demobilized. That's what I see as the biggest problem.
All right. Well, we couldn't let you go without getting some full-on controversy on the air. And so this is just a little teaser for a big book. Frank, thank you.
Thank you.
That was Frank B. Wilderson III. He's a professor at the University of California, Irvine, and the author of Incognegro, a memoir of exile and apartheid. And he was here with me at NPR West.